I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Bush campaign is slamming presumed Democratic Party presidential candidate John Kerry, saying he offered nothing new and contradicted his earlier positions in a speech Kerry delivered yesterday to veterans in Seattle.
We must ensure that lawless states and terrorists will not be armed with weapons of mass destruction. This is the single gravest threat to our security. Any potential adversary should know that we will defend ourselves against the possibility of an attack by unconventional arms. And if such a strike does occur, as Commander-in-Chief, I will respond with overwhelming and devastating force.
Kerry's speech is being compared to one former Vice President Al Gore gave on Wednesday, in which he called the war in Iraq a catastrophe that had resulted in the prison abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib.
How dare the incompetent and willful members of this Bush-Cheney administration humiliate our nation and our people in the eyes of the world and in the conscience of our own people? How dare they subject us to such dishonor and disgrace?
And President Bush started off the week with his speech to the nation Monday night.
Iraq now faces a critical moment. As the Iraqi people move closer to governing themselves, the terrorists are likely to become more active and more brutal. There are difficult days ahead, and the way forward may sometimes appear chaotic. Yet our coalition is strong. Our efforts are focused and unrelenting, and no power of the enemy will stop Iraq's progress.
Well, for a view of this big week in political speeches, we spoke first earlier to Ted Kennedy, senior senator from Massachusetts, and asked him why, as some critics say, the Democratic Party isn't doing enough to distinguish itself from President Bush and the GOP.
Well, of course, I was strongly opposed to the war. This was the wrong war at the wrong time for the wrong reasons.
But as you know, your candidate voted for the war.
That's right. But I am absolutely convinced that he voted for a resolution. Had he been president at the time, we never would have gone to war. That was the difference, that even after the resolution was passed, this administration had a go-it-alone process rather than trying to work with the coalition to contain or even see the removal of Saddam Hussein. So that's really the background. What we are facing now is an administration and the president that made a speech the other night that was sent benchmarks and goals, but did not tell the American people how we were going to get foreign forces in there to provide relief for American forces, how we were going to get help and support and financial investments to offset the American taxpayers, and how we were going to set a time that we were going to see the withdrawal of American troops with honor.
But as you know, Senator Kennedy, many are saying the same thing is missing from John Kerry.
Well, the fact is this administration has never believed in working with the international organizations, and secondly, they have no capability or credibility to do so. John Kerry does. This administration has no plan. They had a brilliant program in order to win the war, and they've had no post-war program, and they're doing the arrangements day by day. That's not a way American foreign policy should be set.
But what is John Kerry proposing, besides, as he said, a humbler approach, a more solicitous approach to organizations like the United Nations and NATO? What specifically is he proposing?
Well, specifically, he will bring these countries into the process where they feel that they are a part of the solution. Once you bring them into that process, as we did in Bosnia, then those countries buy in and they become a part of the process. And that is the pattern that John Kerry, that is dramatically different from the go-it-alone policy of this administration.
As you may know, an ABC Washington Post poll released this week found that 53% of Democrats think the U.S. should withdraw its soldiers from Iraq, even if civil order is not restored there. How does the Democratic Party deal with that?
It's leadership. You can't just look at what a poll says at a particular time and say that you're going to just adopt a policy. It is leadership. John Kerry has tried and true, demonstrated leadership in foreign and domestic policy. He has the experience and the strength to lead this country, in a multinational way in order to bring an end to the conflict in Iraq and to bring American troops back. It has demonstrated quality leadership, which this administration does not have and does not provide. And that is why we're in a quagmire in Iraq. Mm-hmm. President Bush has shifted to the Kerry position, but it's only lip service.
Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts speaking earlier today. Well, we turn now to Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Wayne, we just heard Senator Kennedy say he thinks there is a big difference between the policies of Senator Kerry and President Bush when it comes to Iraq. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do not. And it's really interesting. Your interview was right on target because Senator Kennedy was doing a great job at articulating the Kerry position. That there's a big difference because in November, voters are going to be asked to vote. You vote for this guy or that guy. The Bush people are thinking at this point that at that point, most voters will vote for President Bush and that the Kerry folks will offer themselves, hope to offer themselves up as an alternative. The problem is there's not much difference between these two with respect to what we do now in the war in Iraq.
Yeah, well, and as we know, in the national polls, Bush's numbers on his signature issue, the war on terrorism, have dropped. In a recent CNN poll, Bush now only has a 7-point lead over Kerry, but Kerry's haven't climbed. He apparently is not making the point that there's a difference.
No, he isn't. And I think one of the things that you saw at the end of that interview, Senator Kennedy was saying, you know, it's not just lip service, and President Bush is now moving toward the Kerry position, which I think is arguably true. In fact, both of them are now fairly similar, not identical, but the Bush people have fuzzed it up enough where they're similar on the issue of international involvement in resolving this thing. That's a problem for Kerry because, again, there's not a difference between the two. You're right about the polling. The polling has been devastating for George Bush. But in the end, the Bush people I talk to say that although it's a problem, they're roughly tied if you look at the polls in terms of who would you vote for in November. In the end, the Bush people hope that the decision, which will be in two parts, will be, A, do you want to fire the president? Before B, you'll hire John Kerry. The Bush people believe that in the end, even if people aren't happy about Iraq, they won't vote, at least in the majority, to fire the president.
And Wayne, we also want to know, did we also see the Bush administration seem to switch tacks a little bit this week? There was a major announcement on the possibility of terrorist attacks directed at upcoming events, starting with tomorrow's War Memorial dedication in Washington. And the further announcement of 7 people wanted for questioning. The day after, many critics were saying there was nothing new here. And some question, is this politics in play? Your thoughts in a minute.
Well, it could be politics in play. Who knows? I don't know. I don't know why the decisions were being made. I do know this, that the folks who are steadfast Bush supporters, the base, the 40% out there, are not thinking this is politics at play. There are 40% out there who are going to vote for John Kerry, the Democrat, no matter what, think this is absolutely the manipulation of politics, wag the dog, if you will. Now we're talking about the 20 or ultimately 10% of the swing voters. What will they think? Is this politics or not? Don't know.
And just real quickly, the Nader effect. Recent polls seem to show that Ralph Nader isn't eroding Kerry's numbers because he's pulling voters from both parties and conservative Republicans who have a protest vote.
That's exactly what's happening, and that's what you expect right now. I did a study basically about money, which showed that some Bush people who ultimately will vote for George Bush will talk about Nader right now, like him, but only to hurt John Kerry. In the end, though, the problem for Kerry, to make this brief, the problem for Kerry is that he could lose if indeed the war becomes an ultimate issue. Kerry is not strong enough on it, and Nader becomes an alternative anti-war candidate that draws votes away in places like Washington, Oregon, and New Mexico. It could be a problem for Kerry.
Wayne Slater, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wayne is senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. In the land of dimpled chads, attention is once again focused on the voting rolls. 6 months remain before Florida voters return to the polls in November's presidential election, along with the entire country. But according to the Miami Herald, thousands of voters in Florida who may have been erroneously declared ineligible to vote in 2000 have not been reinstated. And Florida Governor Jeb Bush is asking election officials to purge almost 50,000 more voters he says are ineligible. Joining us on the line from Florida is Gary Feinout of the Miami Herald. Gary, remind us, why were these voters removed from the rolls in 2000 in the first place?
Well, in 2000, the idea was to come up with a comprehensive list of people who shouldn't be allowed to vote, i.e. people who are dead, people who are registered in more than one county, and people who are felons and have not had their civil rights restored. Mm. What's important to remind listeners across the country is that Florida is one of a handful of states that does not automatically restore civil rights to people once they've served their time in prison.
Other states do, and the Roto Rule in Florida was challenged by many groups because they felt that some of those on the list had actually had their rights restored.
Correct. There were people who were had felony convictions from other states that do restore rights, but at the time, the state was saying that they didn't have their civil rights restored in Florida, so therefore they should be purged from the voter rolls. What happened was is that the NAACP and a handful of other groups sued the state of Florida in the wake of the 2000 election. A settlement in that lawsuit was reached in September of 2002. A few months later, the state of Florida's Division of Elections sent out what it called a false positives list of people that it said in 2000 they were on the list, but now under new criteria, they're not on the list. And counties, can you go back and see whether or not these people should be reinstated? What we've discovered is 6 months before the presidential elections, a lot of counties have apparently still not looked at whether or not these people should be reinstated.
Right. And now, separately, the governor wants to purge more names from the rolls. What are those names?
The Division of Elections 3 weeks ago said that they have a list of 47,000 felons who their records indicate have felony convictions in the state of Florida, are registered to vote, and have not had their civil rights restored under the process that's allowed for under law. So far, a lot of the election supervisors around the state of Florida are very nervous about this new list because of what happened 4 years ago. There was a feeling that the list from 4 years ago was not completely accurate.
What is going to happen to these two groups of names, one that the governor wants to purge and the other names from 2000 that people want to get back on the rolls? What's going to happen?
In Florida, we have a very decentralized system, as was evident in 2000. And basically, it's up to the individual election supervisors. The supervisors themselves are going to be meeting in Key West in another week, in which they're going to be discussing as to whether or not they should have a uniform procedure for taking people off the rolls to try to avoid some of the criticism from 4 years ago.
But as you said, we're 6 months away. What are the chances the list is going to be ready by November?
That remains to be seen, and that raises some real serious equal protection issues, although we've been told that Bush v. Gore doesn't apply to future elections.
Gary, what are the perceived politics of all of this?
If you look at the records, it just matches up that probably a lot of people who are on the felon list are probably Democratic voters. And that's just a little bit of simple math in that the majority of people in the prison population in Florida are African American, and the majority of African Americans are registered Democrats. So the politics is such is that the Democratic organizations and some of the liberal organizations in the state of Florida are very concerned that the people who may be purged or may have been purged in the past are people who are tend to vote Democratic as opposed to Republican. The Democratic National Committee put out a statement yesterday that they're very worried about it because they perceive that the people who might not wind up voting are people that they want at the polls voting for John Kerry as opposed to George Bush, the older brother of the governor.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Fineout of the Miami Herald. He spoke to us from Tallahassee. Just ahead, the story of the Uber mom behind the Cheaper by the Dozen films. In real life, she advised five presidents. And later, security at the new World War II memorial. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, an Arkansas woman, Michelle Duggar, gave birth to her 15th child. Well, Michelle might want to pick up a few pointers from Lillian Moeller Gilbreth. Lillian was the inspiration for the Cheaper by the Dozen films, Today's and the 1950 movie that more closely told the story of her madcap family of 14 with a household run by husband Frank, who applied his professional engineering principles to his home life. In real life, Lillian Moeller Gilbreth played far more than a supporting role. She was an award-winning engineer and management consultant in her own right. She served as an advisor to five presidents. Listener Jane Lancaster brought Lillian to our attention recently. Jane had just written a new biography of Lillian, Making Time, A Life Beyond Cheaper by the Dozen. And we were struck by the fact that this was a woman whose achievements we'd never heard about.
In the middle of the last century, in the middle of the 20th century, she was getting medals and honorary degrees practically every 10 minutes, it seems. She was very, very, very well known in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
She also seemed to be having children every 10 minutes. That's right. She was either pregnant or nursing for two decades.
That's right.
How did she present her feelings on that?
She loved babies. I think she got a little exhausted as they grew up to be very boisterous children.
Well, for those who didn't see the 1950 film or read the book on which it was based, the husband is portrayed as the engineer. She's the quiet, supportive, bemused, you know, very serene wife. What was true?
I think she was quiet, but she was not bemused. She knew exactly what was going on. And she was supportive, but she was also an equal partner in the whole procedure.
She was, in some ways, the silent partner to a lot of his engineering and management. They were management consultants?
They were management consultants. They both were. Even from day one, from when, as soon as they got engaged, she was writing to him with suggestions about how to run his business.
And then how to run the family. I'm opening it to a page in your book. There's something called the instruction card. It's a list of the detailed instructions of the day.
Right.
It says item, detailed instruction, and continuous or running time.
That's right.
Number one, detailed instruction, arise, 7 a.m., breakfast, 7:30 to 8. Then there's a little space there. Then 5, begin the day of work, 10 a.m., work on book, 10 to 12, with children, 12 to 12:15. Which raises the question, who was with the children when she wasn't?
Well, by the time that was in force, several of them were at school, mm-hmm. and the babies might be napping. But also, she had living in her mother-in-law for almost all her married life, and her mother-in-law was the household manager. And secondly, they also had living in a cook stroke housekeeper and a handyman.
And so I can hear people now saying, aha, see, she had it easy.
Well, not entirely, because we're looking at 1912 and she'd got about 7 children by then. So most upper middle class people with 7 children in 1912 would have had more servants than that.
Yeah.
So what they were having was a system that developed over time that the children were part of the enterprise and they did some of the work.
Well, in fact, they applied a lot of their management efficiency.
Yes.
I mean, there's pictures of them testing out typewriters and, you know, this was early management science.
Right.
And they were applying it to the family to the extent that they started really regimenting mm-hmm. the family. In 1923, the father, Frank, decided that the family should be run on standing orders.
Yes.
What was that?
Well, the idea that there were a set of instructions that they should follow, just like in a factory. And the eldest would supervise and the youngest would do, essentially. So the eldest would be the foreman. And there were a set of rules that they had to follow. The point is that Frank, by that time, knew he wasn't a well man. He had heart problems. He was trying to set up a system that would keep the family going, even in his absence. But what happened after he died, Lillian wasn't very good at regimenting, and a lot of those formal rules just went by the wayside, and it was a much more informal system where the older kids looked after the younger ones.
Yeah. Do you think that Lillian would have achieved as much as she did in the business world, in the management world, if she wasn't softened by that word mother in front of her?
I think she'd have found it very difficult. But on the other hand, there was such a strong feeling against the idea that mothers should be in the labor force that she gained on some parts and lost on others.
Yeah. You write that someone wrote of her in 1971, if women's lib opponents and women's lib advocates could agree on a patron saint, they might choose Lillian Moeller Gilbreth.
Absolutely. And I think this is part of the reason that her story was ignored for quite a long time. It was very hard to categorize her because she wasn't the sort of heroic foremother that was out there changing the laws. She was content to be pregnant a great deal of the time and content sometimes to be known just as mother. And yet she was changing much of the way we run our lives. Most of our kitchens are now designed on lines originated by her in the late 1920s. Many of the offices, many of the fast food places, all of these are designed following the motion study ideas that she and her husband were developing.
Is there something we can learn from Lillian Gilbreth, or did she have a special situation? You know, why are so many women having such a hard time doing both work and home today?
I think she got her children to cooperate in the family experiment. And maybe that's what we should try and think of, to incorporate the children into the family business, rather than seeing them as separate individuals who have a separate job.
Huh.
What they did from time to time was to use the children as research assistants in what they were doing. So, for example, they had a summer house on Nantucket, and one year Frank had a contract from Lever Brothers to work out the best way of packing soap. So they had all the children lining up, trying to find the best ways of packing soap. So they were incorporating the children into the experimental work. Mm. So the children had an interest in it. So they would then understand what mother and father were doing and want to be helpful.
So the children don't become a part of keeping the parents from being on, they become a part of the family effort.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Jane, thank you so much. Thank you for writing us.
Well, I'm glad I did.
Jane Lancaster's book is called Making Time, Lillian Moeller Gilbreath, A Life Beyond Cheaper by the Dozen. And Monday on Here and Now, a conversation with an American pilot, a POW, during the first Gulf War about his own torture and his feelings on seeing images from Abu Ghraib. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow, Washington, D.C. launches a summer-long tribute to the 16 million men and women who served in and the nearly 500,000 who died in World War II. Over 500,000 people are expected to converge on the Capitol this weekend, the highlight being the dedication of the nation's World War II memorial. And the solemn celebrations come in the wake of this week's terrorist warnings. Joining us on the line is Jack Zahora, reporter for Public Radio's WAMU in Washington, D.C. And Jack, I know you've been to the memorial. What's the feeling there?
Good afternoon, Robin. Well, the feeling is one of security, absolutely. The National Park Police has done a tremendous job over the last 6 months in cooperation with the FBI and Attorney General John Ashcroft, designing a plan that includes two perimeters, actually, an outer perimeter of fences around the area going from the Washington Monument up to the new World War II Memorial, and then an inner fence within the area that's designed just specifically for the sitting area and the stage. Mm. I spoke with one of the National Park Police spokespeople, Sergeant Scott Fear, and I asked him whether or not any of the plans had changed since the new terror alert has just come about. And he said no. He feels that the current plan is comprehensive and provides enough security amidst the new terror alert, and he says basically it is sufficient.
Are we going to see, you know, some of these very elderly soldiers who are going to be sitting in the ceremony tomorrow? I understand there's a 50,000 name waiting list to get in, but those who have tickets, are we going to see them searched?
Yeah, actually we will. When I spoke with Sergeant Fear, he told me that the security is going to resemble airport security. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he did say, though, is that the National Park Service had to think a little differently when designing security for the event, just because over 60% of those attending the memorial dedication are going to be from the World War II generation. So the National Park Service has taken into consideration that there needs to be wider security lanes so that people who are arriving in wheelchairs and walkers will be able to get through. And they're opening up the entrance a little earlier so people have more time to get in.
And to the events, the dedication itself, what's briefly going to take place? Who will be speaking?
Well, there's going to be some bands that are going to be playing some World War II era music, swing and blues and whatnot. And then there's going to be an unveiling by the U.S. Postal Service, a new stamp with the memorial on it. And as far as speakers are concerned, Tom Brokaw, who, of course, wrote the book The Greatest Generation, Tom Hanks will be speaking. He designed a huge fundraiser to get this project underway after he was involved with the movie Saving Private Ryan.
Helped to raise a lot of the private funds that paid for it, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And of course, Bob Dole, Senator Bob Dole, who for over a decade, I believe, has been involved with the planning and for the fundraising of this memorial.
And was seriously injured himself in World War II.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you, there was a lot of controversy over the building of this because of its placement, because of its design, but now it's here. You've talked to soldiers, you've been there. How are people responding to it?
Well, there's one major sentiment. I asked many of the soldiers, when they first arrived, what was your first thought? What was going through your mind, your first impression? And almost every single one of them, including their family members, said, it's been 60 years too late. It's beautiful. It's breathtaking. But I wish that my brother who served or some of the other soldiers who are now too old or sick or in the hospital who can't come could see it right now. But there's been a general acceptance and just an amount of pride for the sense and the feeling the memorial brings of unity.
As you well know, the wall, the Vietnam Memorial, which is also nearby, can bring returning veterans to their knees when they visit it. Do you see these soldiers responding in that way to this? Or
it's a good thing that you brought the Vietnam Memorial, only because there were so many veterans from that era as well who came to visit World War II and pay their respects to the veterans who fought in that war as well. And, yeah, there were people who I interviewed who just broke down in tears. There were wives and brothers and sisters of those who did fight who just felt a sense of awe and appreciation and realized how proud they are of their family members.
I know you want to share one with us. Let's listen.
I didn't think it would ever be done, but boy, it is beautiful. We were forgotten too long, World War II veterans. This is unreal. Just hard to describe, really. I lost two of my brothers, and it's just fantastic.
World War II Navy veteran Melvin Brett speaking about the memorial that will be dedicated tomorrow in Washington, D.C. Jack Zahora, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jack Zahora, reporter for NPR station WAMU in Washington, D.C. The U.S. military is running out of bullets. In fact, it needs 500 million more in the next 5 years because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also because of something known as the Jessica Lynch effect. The U.S. armed forces are using up bullets at such a fast clip, the factories are having trouble keeping up. Joining us on the line from Edina, Minnesota, is Bryce Halliwell. He's spokesperson for defense contractor ATK, which currently has a $200 million contract as the Army's main bullet supplier. Bryce, how many bullets were you providing a few years ago, and how many are you manufacturing today?
When we took over the Lake City, Missouri facility 4 years ago, the plant was producing about 350 million rounds. With the Army, we've made some significant investment in that plant. We've hired more than 1,000 people, and today we're producing about 1.2 billion rounds for the Army.
I understand you're working around the clock on every type of bullet. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about 5.56 and 7.62 rounds, which are basically for M16s, M4s, and machine guns. In addition to that, we produce 50 caliber rounds there for larger guns and then pistol ammunition as well, 20 millimeter.
Well, it makes sense that, you know, there are two wars, one first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq. They will consume a lot of bullets. But what is the Jessica Lynch effect?
Basically, the Army has gone through a real doctrinal change in their philosophy on training. Because of the Jessica Lynch situation, where some troops that were rear echelon troops were captured and unfortunately killed, the Army now wants them trained on a regular basis. So they're using training ammunition at a much higher pace than what they used to.
Right, because this second wave of soldiers, reservists, they were in supply caravans, for instance, in the past, and now they can be right on the front lines.
That's correct. I mean, we've wiped away the front line in Iraq. There is no front line, so every soldier is on the front line, and they need to be proficient in small caliber arms. Mm-hmm. And so they train at a much higher pace than they used to.
And use more bullets.
They use a lot more bullets that way.
Well, I understand that your company is ramping up production, pushing your factory as hard as you can, that other companies might eventually come in and also be suppliers. But in the meantime, it raises the question, and here's this ancient, small thing. And with all the high technology, it still obviously is so needed.
The bullet itself, it is the soldier's best friend. There's no question about it. You have to have small caliber ammunition. You know, high-tech precision weaponry is great when you're going after big targets. If you're going after tanks, you're going after buildings, you're going after anti-aircraft installations. But, you know, the reality of the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is that it is very close combat, and your weapon is a rifle at that point.
Bryce, thank you.
Absolutely.
Bryce Hollowell, spokesperson for ATK, the defense contractor that is also the Army's main bullet manufacturer. Still to come, Mario von Peebles making a movie about his father's groundbreaking 1970s film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. You're listening to Here and Now. The young Chinese pianist Lung Lung made a dramatic entrance on the world stage. It was 1999, and the Chicago Symphony asked him at the last minute to fill in for the ailing pianist Andre Watts. Lung Lung was a virtual unknown, but his emotional exuberance and technical mastery quickly made him among the most heralded of a new generation of classical performers. He was 17 years old. Here, from producer David Shulman, is Lung Lung in his own words.
Basically, it's like talking to play music. It's like, you know, you need to let people know what are you talking about. It's not like, I want to know somebody. This is unclear. Or you say, I want people to know something. Or, you know, sometimes if you phrase it's not right, it's like, I want the people, and you know, it's like that. So music is totally language. For example, Brahms A major intermezzo, for me, it's like someone telling a story for their children. Before they sleep. But then it totally changed. It's more like lovers. Maybe it's a lady say some sweet word to her boyfriend. So it's much more softer and much more intimate. Then you see Brahms start to having hope. Sure that after 20 years you are much more mature, have much more life experience, but it doesn't mean that you play better. You know, because once you have more knowledge, you're worried about this, you're worried about that, and then when you play, it's no fun. There's no always concerns, always like tricky stuff, and you never get out of it. And the music will make no color, no style. So that's why I think in the same time I must pay attention to always try to still play with freshness.
He is 23 years old. Lung Lung, in his own words, was produced by David Shulman with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It was the top-grossing independent film of 1971. Its success prompted the producers of Shaft to switch their lead from a white actor to a black. Variety said it launched a whole new genre of movies called blaxploitation, and the soundtrack launched the then-unknown group Earth, Wind, and Fire. Sweet Sweetback's badass song, director Melvin Van Peebles' revolutionary, if crude, X-rated movie, rocked Hollywood and audiences with its tale of a black man who takes on two abusive racist cops and gets away with it. And to think, Sweetback almost didn't get made.
Got arrested.
Who?
Donovan, a financing man.
Going for him. What about that attorney? We have a deal now.
Yeah, let's just say that financing for this film has been put on the back burner for the foreseeable future. Like the next 5 to 10 years, man. You gotta go in there. You gotta cancel.
A scene from the new docudrama Badass about the making of Sweet Sweetback. It was produced, written, directed by, and stars Melvin's son Mario Van Peebles, who had a role in the original film and now plays his own father, often talking to his fictional younger self. Actor and director Mario Van Peebles joins us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Hello.
Hey.
I have to wrap my brain around that again. Let's think about that.
I'm still trying to do that. It's a hall of mirrors.
It is.
Because here I am playing my father while I'm directing A Fierce Independent, and I'm playing my dad while he was directing A Fierce Independent.
Right.
That's a trip. And then I played his character, Sweetback, as a kid, and now my kid is on my set.
Oh, is that your son? Who plays
my son,
a younger you?
No, my son didn't play me. My son played the little angel that comes to what would be my father, played by me, and inspires him to make this crazy independent flick called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song.
All in the family, so to speak.
It's sort of like therapy you could eat popcorn to.
Did you have any qualms about this, playing your own dad, especially since your relationship was real rough in spots?
Oh, this could have gone horribly wrong. What happened was, I was on the set of Ali preparing to play Malcolm X, and I was being directed by Michael Mann. And we started to talk with Ali, and Ali's got a great sardonic wit, and he would come over to me and say, Van Peebles, if you were any smarter, I'd enjoy your company. And then ask me questions like, how's your daddy doing? He's still getting some? and we started to talk and think about if Ali were the first athlete to use the ring, not just to box, but to stand for something, to stand for an ideal. Melvin Van Peebles was one of the first filmmakers to really use the silver screen, not just to entertain, but to make edutainment. And I was wondering, well, now if you can get the Ali movie done now, could you get the Melvin Van Peebles movie done now? And that I happen to have this sort of genetic track inside on my dad's making of book. Flash forward a couple of weeks, I go to see the old man about getting his book. And I thought he'd give it to me and be flattered, of which, of course, he says, business is business. I love you. I don't want to get screwed on the deal. You can option the book, and whoever plays me, don't make me too damn nice. And that was the start.
And your dad had to pick from the porn industry to get a crew, right? Because he had to skirt the unions. He tried to borrow money from drug dealers, scam artists, but he wanted to put together a diverse crew.
The unions, he had just made Watermelon Man for Columbia Pictures, and he had a three-picture deal. And the unions were 99.9% all-white, all-male, good old boy unions. And they were tough. There was almost like a gangsterism. And he said, look, this time around, I'm going to make a film with a multiracial crew. So he had a ragtag group of filmmakers. A third of the crew, including myself, hadn't really seen a film camera before. So for a lot of folks, it was film school 101. The kick is, though, that 33 years later, when I made my film Badass, I had the same multiracial crew, only now I could have experienced union people because my dad broke down those doors.
We have a scene where you play your dad talking about that crew that he cobbled together. Let's listen.
We start shooting in 3 days. This is a family affair. This is Bob and his lovely wife, Nora. Nora does makeup. Bob is our cinematographer. We have two cameras working, so we also have from New York, Black Latino Filmmakers Coalition, Jose Garcia.
Que viva Puerto Rico libre.
Exactly. All right. On script, we got Randy over here. And our genius of sound is Tommy, backed up by Big T, who'll also be heading up security.
Oh, no, no, man. Hey, hey. Well, I got an answer to a white man on a movie about a brother finally breaking the chains, you dig? Man, we've been answering the whitey for 400 years, blood.
Well, T.T., now hold up. Tommy here is risking his career to be here. He's one of the few motherfuckers here who really knows what he's doing. So why don't you do yourself a favor? You'll learn something. Listen to this man. And your big ass has been listening to Whitey for 400 years? Another month won't hurt.
Is it fair to say, Mario, that if this movie, the original Sweet Sweetback, didn't make your dad, it was going to break him?
Oh, it was tough. By the end, I was trying to help him win. I didn't think my dad would make it. He'd lost sight in his eyes, one of his eyes in particular. He'd lost a lot of weight. My dad was broke. He had to borrow money from a guy who was Bill Cosby, who loaned him $50,000. And at the end, two theaters played it. The first two customers walked out, demanded their money back, and the next show was empty. And the show after that, there were lines around the block. The Panther started to come. Michael Mann, his first date with his wife was to see
my dad's
film Sweetback, right. Yeah. In fact, Michael Mann, as you probably know, is my executive producer on Badass.
Right. Let's talk about you and your relation to the film. You play, as we said, a young Sweetback in the original film. You did as a boy. In that film, your character loses his virginity in a graphic sex scene with a prostitute. You recount the making of that scene in your new docudrama. Child psychologists will be shaking their heads.
Yes, well, they should. However, I would like to try that scene again now. Wouldn't mind another shot at that one.
But the point is, you referred to, you know, often you've said that you and your dad had some, you know, tough patches in your relationship. He could be tough. And what was that like for a kid to be told by your dad, you're going to lose your virginity on screen in my movie because I need you?
Right. Well, first of all, you have to understand, I had already been acting. I was doing a play called 1,000 Clowns, where I had to break down every night. I wanted to act in the film, and I had radical different parents, so it's sort of like growing up in the Addams Family. Now, here's the thing. When I went to do Sweetback, I didn't want to act in that scene. There were other things. When my dad, you know, had the opportunity to bail on this ragtag crew, and his agent kept saying they'll still accept a comedy mail, you know, he could have stepped out and had a nice big house and some nice jewelry and not made it with that kind of crew. He could have bailed at any point, and he didn't. So I started to see a whole different side of him. When the death threat started to come and he started to lose the weight, my problems with being in a scene or cutting my afro, I didn't wind up cutting my afro, by the way, I kept it, were all eclipsed by that bigger event, and that's the only way I can explain it. It's like being in a war and stubbing your toe really badly, but other people are losing their limbs. Suddenly it just sort of pales in comparison. Mm-hmm.
Well, in that war, as you mentioned, there were several skirmishes, and one involved a bicycle that your father's agent, had given
Correct.
To you?
Correct. Yeah, he bought me a lovely bike, and my dad made me return it. The bike had a banana seat, and I'm hoping that if Badass is a big hit, my dad will get me that bike.
Let's listen to that scene, because we have it.
What you got there?
Miss Kaufman bought it for me. I didn't ask for it.
Tomorrow you bring it back.
Bring it back?
You losing your hearing? When I want a favor from Howie, I'll call it in, okay? You don't let people use you to get to me.
What people?
Get in the house.
Mario, your dad is now 71. There's a fleeting glimpse of him at the end of the film. How did he feel about it?
The first time he saw the movie in its entirety was in Toronto, where we sold it. And there were 600 other people. And to watch his face while he watched me play him was something else. And at the end, the crowd stood up. We got a standing ovation. And I said, Pop, what do you think? And he said, well, it's like Seabiscuit on two legs. And that's because at the core of Badass is someone with this impossible dream and, you know, fairly complex relationship with their kid. And now what's happening is that the audience is as diverse as Melvin's crew was.
Well, what do you think about that? Because there is a whole generation growing up now. I mean, I know it's a cult film. The original film is a cult film. But still, there are a lot of people who just assume, well, it's always been the way it is. And what are you hearing from young people? Is this all new to them, this history?
A lot of them, yeah. It's interesting because the folks that are new to it are coming out saying, wow, this is history we never knew. And so there's a feeling across with young folks of being unempowered. And when they see this, it's one of those movies that makes people want to get up there and go and not think that their struggle is unique and see, you know, how to get it done. And so not knowing any of it, I think it's a fun story. It wouldn't be any fun at all if it were just a history lesson. You've got to make a movie that's a kick-ass film at its core and then build all the other stuff around that.
Well, Mario Van Peebles, thank you so much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Mario Van Peebles wrote, produced, directed, and stars in the new film, Badass. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a good weekend and join us again here and now. But you just can't find a pleasure. People around you giving you pressure. Try to resist all the hate that's all around you. If you taste it.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.